Hello and welcome to the Film Show on KBOO. I'm SW Concer, and I'll be joined in just a few minutes by my co-host Jen Chavez. Jen will be talking today with homeless activist Ibrahim Mubarak about the upcoming screening event, Right to Survive, Breaking the Chains. But first, I'm joined on the line from New York by Steve Young. Steve is an author, impresario, and comedy writer whose credits include The Simpsons and Late Night with David Letterman. Steve will be coming to town soon for a live film event at the Hollywood Theater. It's called The Lost World of Industrial Musicals. Steve Young, welcome to the Film Show.
Hello, Conch. So glad to be here with you. Thanks for having me.
Very glad to have you. So tell us, The Lost World of Industrial Musicals. This sounds dramatic.
Yes, it really is. I think probably the last real chunk of 20th century American culture that had never really been examined or understood before. It's really is a whole world of musical theater that was created for corporate conventions and sales meetings, and the public was never allowed to see these things, never allowed to hear these things. I stumbled into it accidentally working on the Letterman show. I used to gather material for a bit called Dave's Record Collection, and I would go to used record stores and thrift shops. I would come back with strange records, and it kept happening. I found these souvenir record albums from company events, and they were musicals, musicals about selling insurance or selling tractors or selling Coca-Cola or silicone products or a thousand other things, and some of them were terrible.
I remember, I'm old enough to remember that show, the old Letterman show and Dave's Record Collection, and to give people a sense of what you're talking about, let's play a cut that actually appeared on Dave's Record Collection.
My bathroom is a private kind of place, very special kind of place.
I don't know where that song is going, but I'm with her all the way. I just want to know what happens next.
Yeah, well, for years I loved that song. That's from the 1969 American Standard musical, The Bathrooms Are Coming, which was performed for plumbing fixture distributors. And so I already just loved it on a conceptual level. Then the music is actually really, really well done. Like I was saying, some of these things are not good, but the ones that are good are so startlingly good that it gets your attention. And then the new frontier for me in recent years is film. I've started collecting films from some of these corporate shows, and that's what I'm going to be presenting at the Hollywood Theater. I actually have, thanks to the woman you just heard singing there, she gave me a 16 millimeter film of that show.
So you will be projecting analog film at the Hollywood Theater the way God intended. I love it.
Well, I'm not bringing the actual 16-millimeter film canisters. It's all digital clips. But, you'll definitely see this is from a different planet, basically, of vintage film. It definitely has that feel, stuff from the 60s and 70s.
Technicolor?
I don't know what you call it when it's vivid color that's often faded over the years. Some of the sort of red shift.
Oh no, Technicolor doesn't fade, so it would be that would be some of the later ones. But what's fascinating to me is that some of these musical composers are really big names. I mean, went on to be big names. Sheldon Harnick and Jerry Bock, who wrote Fiddler on the Roof, for example.
Yeah, I had no idea growing up anything about Broadway. I had to learn all this sort of backwards and upside down later. But I had this Ford Tractor musical souvenir record album that I liked, and I showed it to a friend, and he turned it over and looked at the back and said, "Oh my God, do you realize who these people are? They wrote Fiddler on the Roof." And to me, they were just the Ford Tractor musical guys. But I've actually interviewed Sheldon Harnick now, a documentary film I'm involved with where trying to track some of these people down, and he recalled
great
fond memories of working on this stuff in the 50s when he was starting out. It paid very well, great practice, you learned your craft.
Well, let's play a brief clip from Golden Harvest. I think it's a Ford,
Ford
industrial
tractors,
music, yes. Right.
Turn your tractors and implements to a bumper crop of dollars and cents. Gonna be a golden harvest in 1959, gonna be a lot more buyers to sign the dotted line with the new Ford tractors. The future's looking fine.
By God, that's jaunty.
Yeah, you can tell also that it's really not for the public, because you have things about there's going to be more buyers and they're going to sign the dotted line. It's all about getting people revved up to sell things. So it really is sort of internal propaganda we were never supposed to hear. And part of the perverse side of me loves the fact that I'm hearing and seeing things that were not meant for us. But it's also just bizarrely entertaining and often very surreal. The films that I'm showing really do feel like they're almost from some alien civilization. It's hilarious and weird and surprising and sometimes touching.
Well, I'm looking forward to it because I was a big fan of Mad Men, and this seems like a very Mad Men sort of thing. These were mostly produced in the 50s and 60s, and it's interesting, you know, these were folks, as you said, who were honing their craft, who went on to do maybe some more artistic projects. But at the time, they were working for patrons, pretty much. And later in the 60s, you know, it seemed like, well, artists got more of a sense that that sort of thing was selling out. It was more of a problem. But it seems to have come full circle nowadays. In the 21st century, musical artists, visual artists, video artists, they're kind of sanguine about the idea that they're going to have to work for a corporate master and maybe they'll get to do some stuff on their own at some point.
Yeah, well, the pendulum swings back and forth. This stuff really, by the early 80s, had kind of seemed old hat, and there was new technology, and just when the economy gets bad, these shows were usually the first thing to go. But I found, to my surprise, that it has sort of come back in the 21st century. I've seen Walmart the Musical from 2006, which was a very slickly produced full-book musical. It was shown to sales associates and people within the company, again, not for the public to see. But
was there a scene where the employees get locked in the back room?
Oh, I think they like to focus more on the exuberance of what a great future we're all going to have together. And
I see. Maybe
impressive.
Maybe it was the bouncy smiling face was the narrator. I don't know.
Yeah, there was something akin to that. I mean, they did a good job on it. But really, my favorite stuff is sort of this golden era, 50s into the sort of end of the 70s. That's kind of the sweet spot for me. And by the way, that woman who was singing My Bathroom, mm-hmm. Here's how deep I've gotten into this stuff. I now know that woman, and I've met her and interviewed her. And 45, 46 years later, after she did that show, I brought her up on stage at one of my shows last year, and we sang that song together.
Oh.
It was actually a surprisingly powerful moment. Well, I love that stuff about it, too.
Well, she has a beautiful voice, and there's just kind of an amazing range of styles that are represented in your shows. And here's now, for fans of the KBOO show, the Tiki Cha-Cha Club, here's a show that might be appreciated by that crowd, that lounge music crowd.
Our Lord and Master is a champion dealer, so of course we live in style and luxury. And once he starts to sell the 700s, then life will simply be sheer ecstasy.
Gosh, it's getting sultry in here all of a sudden.
Yeah.
That's the harem song. Right.
Harem's 1975 show for Dominion Road Machinery Company, which was actually a Canadian company making road graders. And this is a very rare show. I think I've only heard of like three copies of that record ever turning up. But this perhaps cheesy, but also surprisingly fun and engaging fake Middle Eastern harem song stuff with all this lyric and story about selling road graders. It just seems like pure madness, and I love it, and I love to tell people about it.
That's something very Dada-esque, as I, you know, in my... So I want to talk about this book that you've authored, co-authored with Sport Murphy. It's called Everything's Coming Up Profits, The Golden Age of Industrial Musicals. And you're also, you said you're working on a documentary.
Yes, after the book came out a couple of years ago, a friend of mine who's a filmmaker said, I think there's a documentary in this, which I would like to work on if you would be interested. And I said, I think that would be terrific. So I'm not a filmmaker, but I've had a lot of fun being on this project and interviewing people, famous people, Florence Henderson, Martin Short.
Oh, wow.
They both were doing this stuff back in the day. My own boss, Dave Letterman, who never did industrials, but the project grew out of my work for him, and he's become very interested in the project and likes to see where it's going. And wandering around the country trying to track down people who never thought anyone would come to ask them about their work. Like Pat, the woman who sings My Bathroom, she really did not see this second phase of her life coming all this time later. So it really also does bring to light a new way to think about American culture in the 20th century and how companies used to have this perhaps different relationship with their workers and, hey, we're all this family and we're working together and we're going to work together for decades at a time. And now I think we don't quite have that anymore, and people don't assume they'll work for the same company for decades at a time. And so it's also a bit of an exploration about what did we used to have that we might have lost and what's valuable to learn from it that we could use again.
This sounds like a real cultural event. Steve Young will be hosting The Lost World of Industrial Musicals at the Hollywood Theater on July 20th at 7:30 p.m. Steve, thanks so much for joining us.
Well, Conch, thank you so much for the opportunity. As you can tell, I love to talk about this stuff and show it off. And the songs are great and the films are unbelievable. And I hope a lot of people will come out and have the wiring in their brains redone by this stuff.
It'll be great to see you in Portland. Talk to you soon.
Yep. Okay, thanks a lot.
You feel your product's not enough. You feel it is enough to stop. Silicones, silicones. What it may need may not be much. What it may need is just a touch of silicones.
You are tuned in to The Film Show on KBOO. I'm SW Conser. And I'm joined now by my co-host, Jen Chavez, who's going to be talking with housing activist Ibrahim Mubarak about an unusual documentary project that will be coming to Portland's Clinton Street Theater.
If you've driven down West Burnside in downtown Portland in the past several years, surely you've seen the wall of colorfully painted doors just under the Chinatown gate, adorned with slogans like "House Keys, Not Handcuffs." Within those doors lies Right to Dream 2, an organized, self-run, city-sanctioned rest area for houseless people. With the support of partnering advocacy organization Right to Survive, R2D2 provides a place for folks experiencing poverty to safely lay their heads, as well as amenities like a kitchen, computer lab, clothing donations, and more. Since its inception in 2011, the rest area has faced backlash from various communities, both in its current location and potential new ones. As it stands now, the rest area is set to move into the Central East Side Industrial District, much to the chagrin of the area's litigious business and neighborhood groups. Ibrahim Mubarak, the co-founder of both organizations, thinks that if housed people are exposed to the humanity and the reality of homelessness, they begin to see through the stereotypes about houseless people, which are reinforced at every turn. So on July 14th at 7 p.m., KBOO and the Clinton Street Theater will present Right to Survive, Breaking the Chains, a special screening of documentary films about the work of Right to Survive and Right to Dream 2, and about day-to-day life for people living in poverty. Ibrahim and other board members will be in attendance for a post-film discussion as well. I sat down with Ibrahim this week to hear more. Ibrahim, a pleasure as always. Thank you for joining me today.
Likewise. Thank you for having me.
Could you explain Right to Survive versus Right to Dream 2, how they're different?
What happened after I left Dignity Village and I moved back into the streets, the houseless population was growing, and it was certain communities that the city wasn't addressing, like the LGBT community, the runaways from foster care, and families living in cars and abandoned buildings because they want to keep their family together. That means what, no family shelter. And then couples who wasn't married but wanted to stay together. And then we ran across something that is going to take the city by storm because of the runaways, the emancipated youth. So people knew that I was one of the co-founders of Dignity Village, and they kept coming to me saying, you need to help us, you need to help us. And And I said, no, you need to help yourself. They wanted to get organized. So with $10 in my pocket and my bike, I went and made flyers and said, I'm forming a new organization. Who want to come? Who want to come? And that's how Right to Survive came about. Right to Survive is a direct action grassroots organization that addresses problems of people living in poverty and on the streets, where we go and educate them of their constitutional, human, and civil rights and teach them how to be advocate for themselves, you know, to empower them. The city will allow people that live in houses to come out and pitch tent overnight on the sidewalk, then wait for the parade. And so since we're a direct action group, we put on a direct action called Pitch a Tent, and we put tents along a parade route, and we told all the houseless people to come in. And the first year, we had like two blocks because people were still reluctant on coming because police kept sweeping them and the houseless phobia, they was being attacked. The few that was there asked us, what happens now? That was the best sleep we had. What do we do? And we all looked at each other and we didn't know. The landowner of 4th and Burnside, Michael Wright, was angry with the city officials because he wanted to do stuff with his land to make a living, and they wouldn't let him do it. And I guess he said it in a rage of anger, or maybe he knew what he was talking about. You have to ask him. He said, well, I just give it to that guy who found Dignity Village, and voila. We was thinking about what to do and how to do it. And so I noticed that the comment that was coming from the people was rest, rest, rest. So we said, let's do a rest area, because people can't sit on the sidewalk. They get criminalized for laying on the sidewalk. I said, or loitering. I said, well, let's make it look beautiful. Let's make it like benches and shrubs. You can have a domino table or a card table where they can just come sit down and rest. I said, no, a rest area where they can sleep. So they said, well, let's try it your way first. If it don't work, you know, we'll try it another way. So in doing that, they wanted to know what to call it. And so Terry Yang, or Terry Light, said, let's call it R2-D2, you know. Right, because we had Right to Survive. Let's say call it Right to Dream. Like, and so we added the T-O-O on it, because houseless people have a right to sleep too. Mm-hmm. So it became R2-D2. And so Right to Survive is a direct action. Right to Dream 2 is Right to Survive direct action as an operational rest area for houseless people.
So we're here to talk about an event that you have coming up in July, where there's going to be several documentary films shown about Right to Survive, direct actions, and Right to Dream 2, and what it's like day-to-day at the rest area. So I wonder if you could tell us about how you guys got hooked up with these filmmakers, and what type of things did they capture? What can folks expect from this film screening?
Well, we want to go back to the beginning when we was figuring out, negotiating with each other or congregating, how we was going to do Right to Survive as a direct action. We certainly have, when Right to Dream 2 was first put up, and I first pitched a tent. When you're doing a direct action and everybody hear about it, get by storm, you have all these people, can I make a documentary? Can I do film? So I just said, yes, you know, and other organizers said, yes, and we was taking films, you know, document our steps on how to do it so we can keep track on how, if it's successful, it became. And so in doing that, you got tons and tons of people taking, you know, it's like the paparazzi.
How does it feel like, because I interview you, people interview you all the time, to Right to Dream 2, how does it feel to be the subject of documentaries and interviews all the time?
Well, it give me this opportunity to be an example to the houseless community, that when your mind is made up and you don't want to live on the streets anymore, and your situation in the past won't allow you to get productive, you got to find a way yourself. And so it gives me that opportunity to say, look, Mom, no hands, you know, look at me. Look at me, look at what I'm doing, you know. Mm-hmm. So the houses people see that, and they know me when I was on the streets and stuff. And they know where I come from, and I tell them, if you know me and you know where I was, if I can do it, you can do it. So it gives me that opportunity. It makes me feel good to speak up. Otherwise, I shy away from it because mm-hmm. it's not this movement. It's not Ibrahim. It's houseless. So, but then how can I get them involved if I'm not out there doing these things and showing them that this is what can happen?
How do you hope or how do you think these films will make an impact on viewers that might be housed?
Well, for some strange, odd, uncouth thinking frame of mind, people think that houseless people are some foreign or different, not human for mm-hmm. some. I don't understand that. But this is show the humanity part of houselessness. This is show what people go through doing things. It shows that we can organize ourselves. It shows that we like to have fun. It's not all, like people think houselessness is all drugs and prostitute and stealing and being lazy.
Right, and that's
negative.
That's right. The reason for right. those conditions. Like
exactly,
that. Yeah, yeah.
Exactly. So uh-huh. this is show a different outlook on houselessness. You know, you take that capitalist viewpoint. When you see a houseless person on TV, on the movies, they usually in urine-drenched clothes by a burning barrel and with a wine bottle, give me more money so I can get drunk, you know, I'm running mm-hmm. out of wine. But that's not, that's the stereotype, houseless phobia thing about houseless people. So I hope that the house community can take this, what they seeing, and see how we building communities, we uplifting ourselves, that we are intelligent people, we are human, we are beautiful people. Do the house people know your neighbors? Do y'all speak to each other? It's just high and by. Do y'all sit down and talk and sup with each other and network? I don't see that in neighborhoods and communities anymore. Mm-hmm. But the houseless people are doing that. And also, they more environmental friendly than what most people think because they have to live in an environment. So it's just no place for them to put their waste. And if it was, I think that stigmatism would be taken off the houseless people.
You're telling me about how you're kind of shy, and yeah. I'm kind of the same way. And I would imagine for some houseless people who have been the subject of harmful stigmas and stereotypes for so long that it would be easy to be shy. Do you feel like there are complications with people maybe being a little shy or being hesitant about being filmed or doing interviews or something? Or do you think that this type of media representation of what being houseless is really like is like a good thing for people, is beneficial, is what folks want?
That's an excellent question, because we in the houseless community, you don't get to wash your clothes like people in the house. You don't get to take a shower or fix yourself up. And so a lot of them can be reluctant on their appearance. A lot of them been abused mentally and derogatory, saying you ain't gonna be this, or when you go in places you get chased out. So it makes them self-conscious and wondering what you up to. You know, you dog me out or you make me seem bad. And so a lot of people do shy away. But since Right to Survive and Right to Dream too, we've been educating people and they've been seeing their peers on TV or in the newspaper or in magazine, that, and we educate them, and they start to step up and say, hey, you know, I have something I want to say. And that's the thing that what we trying to empower the houseless people. You know, you say nobody listen to you, this is your opportunity for people to listen to you. Even you say like a sentence or something, tell your story, let people know the reality on how you got here, why you here, what's going on, why you here, and why you still here.
Mm-hmm. Well, great. And so a lot of really insightful filmmaking is going to be on showcase at this event. And I mm-hmm. just want to remind people it is Thursday, July 14th at 7 p.m. at the Clinton Street Theater. Thank you for sharing so much information about these films and media representation. For closing words, where can people go to find out more about Right to Survive and Right to Dream 2?
You can go on our website at righttosurvive.net, and you can go to righttodream2.pdx. And I want to say another upcoming event that we do on July 30th is the Best Graffiti Artist Contest, where they express their feeling on houselessness. And I think this year is going to be environmental justice.
Ibrahim Mubarak of Right to Survive, Right to Dream 2, thank you so much for taking the time to talk to me today.
Thank you so much. And thank you, listening audience. And keep listening to this radio show. It's got good information. It's awesome.
Thank you, Jen. Jen Chavez was talking with Ibrahim Mubarak about the crowdsourced documentary project Right to Survive, Breaking the Chains. It'll be coming to Portland's Clinton Street Theater on July 14th. You're listening to The Film Show on KBOO. I'm SW Conser. And now, back to Jen for this month's film events calendar.
Here's a few local film events coming up in the next month. On June 27th, the Portland, Oregon Women's Film Festival continues its POW monthly series at the Clinton Street Theater with 7 and 9 p.m. screenings of But I'm a Cheerleader. The dark comedy explores LGBTQ romance and satirizes gay conversion therapy. More info at cstpdx.com. On June 29th, the Northwest Film Center hosts an evening with Juno Underground Motion Picture Society for an 8:30 event. Filmmaker and Jump Society director Pat Race will attend to present a program of short works from the Alaskan Film Collective. More info at nwfilm.org. On June 30th, the Northwest Film Center presents the 2016 Oregon Media Arts Fellowship Awards. The 7 p.m. ceremony will honor this year's fellowship recipients, filmmakers Rose Bond and Pam Minty, who will both talk about their upcoming films. More info at nwfilm.org. On July 3rd, the Clinton Street Theater presents the premiere screening of Paying the Price for Peace at 7 p.m. The documentary follows Brian Wilson, an anti-war activist who survived being run over by a military train during a protest in 1987. Brian Wilson, a Portlander, will be in attendance for a post-film Q&A discussion along with the filmmakers. More info at cstpdx.com. Filmmaker D.A. Pennybaker will be in attendance for two special screenings in July at the Hollywood Theater. On July 6th at 7 p.m., the Hollywood will screen a double feature of two of his classic music documentaries, Don't Look Back and Ziggy Stardust and the Spider from Mars. Conversation with the filmmaker between films. More info at hollywoodtheater.org. And on July 7th, the Portland Eco Film Fest continues at the Hollywood with the Pacific Northwest premiere of Unlocking the Cage at 7:30 p.m. The newest film by D.A. Pennybaker and his collaborator Chris Hegedus, the documentary focuses on efforts to change animal welfare laws. Both filmmakers and the animal rights lawyer at the center of the film will be in attendance. More info at portlandecofilmfest.org. On July 13th, the Northwest Film Center will screen the best of its 42nd Northwest Filmmakers Festival at 7 p.m. The touring shorts program of festival highlights from November returns to Portland with many filmmakers in attendance. Also, the submission deadline for this year's fest is August 1st. More info at nwfilm.org. And beginning July 14th and running every Thursday through late August, the Northwest Film Center presents its annual outdoor screening series, Top Down Rooftop Cinema. Screenings take place atop Hotel Deluxe's downtown parking garage. July films include Plan 9 from Outer Space, Raising Arizona, and She's Gotta Have It. Doors and refreshments at 7, music at 8, showtime at dusk. More info at nwfilm.org. And that about wraps it up. Have a great month, everybody.
Thank you, Jen. And thanks to our guests today, Ibrahim Mubarak of Right to Survive and Steve Young with the Industrial Musicals Project. Thanks also to the Oregon Media Production Association for their support and collaboration. And thanks to all our listeners on the radio dial and on the web. The audio for this show, as well as our extended interviews, will be available later today on our archive page, kboo.fm/thefilmshow. And you can keep up with us on Twitter at @KBOOFilmShow. Now stay tuned for an afternoon of music on your homegrown Portland radio station.
We'll be right back.